My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here today. I'm intrigued by that introduction. My story has changed recently.
That's what you say.
Well, I've stopped drinking. But somebody from the grapevine?
Yeah, the grapevine.
Oh, well. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm very pleased to be part of this convention. This kind of brings my AA life to completion now. I've sat at a dais with the founder of AA, and now I've sat in a dais with the founders of the Hilton Head Convention. Well, after that, there's nothing much left, just... But I want to thank the committee and John, who invited me to come and speak. Appreciate it. I've known John for a lot of years. John embarrassed me tonight and really made me feel sheepish, which takes something. I submitted a little chit to the treasurer for my remission of my plane fare. And John said, "I sent you that 2 months ago." Oh, I knew that. I hate that sort of thing. But I do want to... I had a kind of a tough trip here because Thursday night we had a big board of directors meeting where I am and work, and I'm the corporate secretary. And then I had to just rush out of there, just had time to get to the airport to catch the red eye to get here. I had to catch the red eye because somehow I wouldn't get here till 9 o'clock last night otherwise, and I wanted to hear Sandy and be part of the meetings. And I got... And I don't know if you ever had... Riding the red eye, 25 years ago, I told my travel agent, if you ever put me on another red eye, I'm going to fire you. And so this time I put myself on the red eye. And I can sleep on a plane anywhere. I've traveled all over the world. I used to travel, except when you have to sleep. Then you can't sleep. And the plane was full, and some fat guy next to me went, I got off the plane in Charlotte. I was just dead and waited a couple hours, caught another plane here, and I got off the plane. Oh, man. And then a lovely lady, Cindy Zalud, picked me up as my hostess. And, you know, it's unusual having a woman come down to pick you up because you hate to see women carry your heavy bags. I literally had to turn my head and shut my eyes. But she has really been a delightful hostess, maybe the best one I've ever had that I can recall, because she's everything. Every time I needed something, she was there, and when I didn't need something, she let me alone. And Cindy, thank you very much. I tried to tell her about the big book, and she told me about Cadillacs. But it's been a very, very good weekend, I think. I've enjoyed the speakers. I enjoyed... our Friday night speaker, who I've known for many, many years, and a good AA, a good member of AA. And our son this morning, our speaker, who has always been a delight to me. I sponsored her sponsor for years, and she's been always a charming lady. This afternoon, we heard this wonderful workshop on relationships. And tomorrow morning, we'll hear another great talk from Peggy, which is a fine speaker. I'll tell you what I think of Peggy as the speaker. I bring her out to speak to Los Angeles on my birthday every year. She's my speaker. And my job is to fill in now before the dance and entertainment. But this wasn't a bad trip, really. If you want to tell you about a bad trip, a couple of years ago I was speaking in Reykjavik, Iceland. Now that's a long way to go. That's 2,000 miles past any length. You just are way out there somewhere. And on the way back, I was tired. It was Sunday night. I got to Minneapolis, missed the plane in Minneapolis, had to wait 3.5 hours. Nobody's around the airport. Sat in the red carpet room, which is the United frequent flyer room, and sat there just tired and out of it, and had to go to the bathroom, and which happens. And I went in the bathroom. We have a neat little washroom there with two little stalls sitting side by side. And I sat in one of the stalls and was thinking about things, and all of a sudden, a voice comes out of the other side and says, "Hi there." I ignored it. The voice said, "What are you doing tonight?" I thought, I better get this settled right now. So, I'm going back to Los Angeles to see my wife and my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. We're going to have a good get-together, but thank you for asking. You'd think that'd do it, wouldn't you? Pretty soon the voice said, we could really have some fun if you wanted to tonight. And I was tired, and I was a little more intolerant than I sometimes am. I don't know what your problem is, pal, but why don't you just drop it? Just do what you're in here to do. Let me alone, will you? There was a long pause, and the voice said, I'll have to call you back. This jerk in the next stall won't shut up. Now, that's what I call a bad trip. But anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be. I was thinking to the various speakers, so we all have different backgrounds and different stories, and we hopefully come together to merge to make one kind of good weekend. I'm in a little different situation, I suppose, than almost anybody in Hilton Head Island. Yesterday, Thursday morning, when I went to work, I did something that probably none of you do. I got in my car out by the ocean and drove downtown on the Santa Monica Freeway and parked in my parking lot. Then I had to get out of my car and I'd step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction to get to my office, where I spent all day and working, and went to the board meeting, came out, stepped over the bodies of dying men, women, and children to get in my car to leave. And I do that every morning and every evening. And I've been doing it for a long time. And they say, well, why don't you, these people are dying, and they do die, and they, why don't you help them? And I can't tell you how many times over the years I've helped, try to help people on that street, because I know that street intimately. I used to be on that street. And it's very frustrating, because I have an answer that works well for people, not because of me, but because of the answer. And there's a way out, and you don't have to be here, and it makes me frustrated. It used to make me frustrated. Then I had to realize, if sobriety could be conveyed by good wishes and good people trying to do the right thing, why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and good people tried to help me. And not because I came to AA, but it just happened to be that period of my life. When I came, I was a relatively high-bottom alcoholic, a writer, someone successful writer. And over the years, I became a medium-bottom alcoholic. And finally, I became a low-bottom alcoholic. And the last day I drank, I was in a situation that people like me and my background and intelligence and ability can't be in. Two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in downtown Los Angeles and stay out of here, you mooch. I tried to explain to them, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair, you know. I stood outside of that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning, and it was cold like... seemed as cold as it is this morning. It wasn't that cold, but when you're cold and alone and it's raining, it seems that cold. And I stood there and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it in other people. And perhaps some of the people in this room have had this feeling. That's the feeling of suddenly realizing there is no longer any friendly direction. It's all bad news everywhere. There's no direction that you're going to follow. Someone's going to be glad to see you. And it's a terrible feeling. And I didn't know what to do. Some old guy came up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your identification, all your personal effects in the car you left it. You lost in Phoenix. I had been hired, or not... had been retained to drive a car from Dallas to Los Angeles to help me get out of Texas. And I had all my stuff in it, and I got drunk and lost it in Phoenix. Never did see it again. Never saw any part of it. He said, you have no idea. You remember Phoenix, he would have said. That's the night where you got arrested that night, went up in jail, and accidentally threw up on some guy's bunk. Remember, he's the guy that kicked your front teeth out. That's why your mouth is bleeding and you have no teeth. He said, your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you. Your stepfather's so tired of you calling her collect and giving her a sad story, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. That's where you are. Now, you've been mucking around AA for almost 10 years, in and out, and sneering and laughing at these people and using it as a tool to get out of retribution on a job. Why don't you go back, if you said, why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens? And if I were in the mood to be honest, I'd have had to say, pal, you don't understand. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I wish I were. It would save me a lot of problems. And he might have said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I wouldn't have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have to do what people like me do when they get cornered and afraid. And I take defense behind bluster. And I say things like, get away from me, you son of a bitch, or I'll crack you. Leave me alone! Because I don't want to get close enough to know I'm afraid. But I wouldn't have known how to explain. I got problems. My God, I know I got problems. I've had problems as a little boy. When I was a little boy, I always felt there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is, but I know people seem to like me till I get close to them, and they don't seem to like, they see something missing in me. I don't know what it is. And I don't fit in very well, and I don't seem to have the gift of being able to talk easily. And I feel tense when I'm around people I want to look good to. And I always want to run with the people who step above me, not with the people who step below me. And they don't want to run with me somehow. And it's almost as though if you're supposed to go through life like this, as far back as I remember, there's always some reason or another. It's always like this inside of me. And I thought when I grew up, it'll be different. But I grew up, and it wasn't different. But when I grew up, I had some, developed some skills and verbal skills and mental skills. And I had made some money. And I decided to do something about it. So I spent several $1,000s in psychoanalysis to find out why this was. And I'll tell you, psychoanalysis is really a great thing. I always liked it. And I don't know why, because all you ever find out is how you've been hurt in ways you hadn't realized yet. You know. And you spend money to find out. It's really, I found out I'd been repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Now, you may have never heard of the Norwegian Lutheran Church down here. Down here, they got some second-rate imitation called Southern Baptists. Our dropouts become Southern Baptist ministers. Just one little anecdote about Norwegian Lutherans. Even if you're married for 30 years, you'd never make love standing up. Just in the fear that some passerby might think you were dancing. It's a tough church. And I always liked the church. I was catechized and confirmed, and I learned that about the 10 big ones, if you don't break them. And as I grew older, it seemed to me that I needed more fun than other Lutherans, and I accidentally broke some here and there. I didn't mean to. And one day I didn't remember to keep the Sabbath day holy, and I didn't always treat my mother and father with the respect. And I had just on and on. I knew I was a sinner anyway. But I found out later it had repressed me, which is one of the reasons I burst loose sometimes. I remember explaining that to an arresting officer one night. Get in the car, asshole. I discovered I'd been hurt by the depression. I didn't even know there'd been a depression. But once they explained it to me, I could see it. I just went out there and think, Jesus, it's amazing I'm doing as well as I am. I have to cherish this water, and I'll tell you why. There are 12 glasses up here and no water to put in them. This is the last one. I had a lot of problems, emotional problems. I read books. I read philosophers because I was kind of an imitation intellectual. I read Nietzsche. I love Nietzsche, if you ever read Nietzsche. He's such a sarcastic, anti-establishment, everything. And the one thing I liked best one of his pieces talks about, he says, God is dead. Why are you so concerned about God? Perhaps he once existed to set the orbs of the world, but look around you. Chaos. Human behavior in chaos. There's no God. God is dead. And I read that as the best news I had that year. Because if God isn't dead, I am screwed. In fact, in Chicago, and there's a theological seminary, has this big thing on the wall. God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. Unfortunately, beneath it, it says, Nietzsche's dead. Signed God, 1906. Well, I read books and tried to read German philosophy. I don't know if you ever read German philosophy. You can't even understand it. What? What does this mean? Unless people are looking. And then you say, how true. I tried a lot of things. I moved from city to city. I did a lot of things. But the thing that really saved me the most has happened when I was 15 years old. A screwed up kid. It's amazing to stop and think about this. When I was 12 years old, my parents got divorced. And, you know, so what? Can you believe this? At the age of 12 years old, I had never heard of a divorce. I'd never known of one. Nobody in our church or our family ever got a divorce. So talk about a protected life. And all I knew is that my parents left, departed. My father, somehow there was something wrong. And at that time, I was doing straight A's in school, and I had lived a very strong, structured life, which we all did. And I'd been shoved ahead in school 1 year and then another half a year. And I was getting along famously. And without even knowing what was going on, I instinctively did the worst thing anybody could do. I look back and see it now. I began playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline and structure. And I outsmarted him again and again. My mother gave me hell, I'd run to my father and tell him stories about her. If he gave me hell, I'd run to my mother. If they got at me both, I'd go to my grandma. And by the time I was 15, I'd outsmarted them all. I was flunking out of school. My life was a shambles. I felt bad every day. My friends didn't want to be around me anymore. And I just had outsmarted everybody. And what saved me, the war started. And I thought, I'll just get away. I'll go and saw a couple of propaganda movies. I'll go to join the Marine Corps and kill Japs, and I'll feel better. I'll be back a hero. And I hitchhiked to San Francisco. And I'd never hitchhiked before. I'd never been away from home very much before. A guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis. I said, how do you get to San Francisco to hitchhike? Well, out that road there. A car stops. Where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco? He said, so am I. Hop in. And away we went. Turned out he was in the Navy going back to his ship. I don't know why he ever picked me up. He must have been a saint. We traveled for days, stop at night. There were no motels. There were travel courts. He'd buy me a bed, bought my meals, let me prattle on. It's just amazing. I told him I wanted to be in the Marine Corps and kill Jeff. I said, well, you're a little small. You're only about 5'4", and you got pimples all over your face. So we look like a killer. But you might get in the Merchant Marine because they're taking anybody that's alive. Anybody. So he told me how to get to the Merchant Marine. Go out there and tell him you're 16. And she dropped me off the Coast Guard office in San Francisco. I still remember that. Being San Francisco, smelling the ocean for the first time in these big buildings. And went, I said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. Guys, what are you? Fill out this application, kid. I filled out. She said, well, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. I told my mother I was going to Superior to visit my aunt. And that's why nobody was looking for me, really. And they issued me Siemens papers right there. No training, no nothing. They just sent another guy out on the National Maritime Union. They had to sign a waiver for our dues. I didn't know what a waiver was or what dues were, but they took us to the Embarcadero, put us on a big ship, and that afternoon we were on our way to the South Pacific. And it really was a lot of fun for about an hour. That's Treasure Island, where the World's Fair was. Mm-hmm. That's Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. But then there's nothing after that, boy. And they stuck me in a room. They called it a cabin. It wasn't a cabin. People in Wisconsin know that cabins have logs. This was a room with three of the worst type of people than any small, skinny, frightened Norwegian Lutheran dumbbell can be with. And these people are called men. And they give, what the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there was a little tension. I told them a joke or two that I used to go over good in study hall. And out there, get your bunk and dummy up. I was in this bunk. And I still remember that day. It was hot. The ship was moving. I never had any feeling like this. And these guys start talking. And I, my God. I was in a room with sinners. I mean big time sinners. I thought I was a sinner. I was nothing. These guys were sinners. And they'd all been in San Francisco several days with the ship, but they had been doing terrible things. And bragging and joking. I remember thinking, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people. Couldn't believe my ears. But eventually I found my niche on that ship. I became the ship fool after a couple of days. Hey, kid, get on the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And then sit around and drink whiskey every day after the watch. And not just the, you know, they said, you know, we weren't supposed to have it on the ship, but who's going to stop? These guys are the dregs of the earth, you know, really. Just, they'd have been pirates any other day. And they're drinking. And one day the guy turned to me. He said, how about you, Junior? You think you're mad enough for a little snort? He shoved that bottle in my face, and I drew the line there. I might be dumb, but I'm not a Catholic. And I just prepared to demolish him. I was going to say, all right, you get that bottle out of my face. I've never told you this before, but I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. And we don't drink whiskey like you people do. And I promised my mother and grandmother I never would. And I'm a little better type of person, I guess. And don't you ever do that again. I was just about to lay that on him. He said, why do you think you're man enough? And I heard this voice say, God damn right. So I had my first drink of whiskey, and I threw it up, and they laughed at me and ridiculed me. And, you know, to this day, I don't know any emotion that's worse than public ridicule, public embarrassment. I just wanted to hit these guys if I had gun and shot. Nothing I could do. I thought later there was one thing I could have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute. I could have, lean over, you. Yeah. Take that. But all the way across the Central Pacific, I take a sneak in that guy's sea bag, drove around and take a drink of whiskey and throw it up, and I hated it. But I wanted them to think I was a man. I didn't realize nothing I did would have made them think I was a man because I wasn't a man. And every day I'd wipe it up, and oh, God, I got to do this. We come into Pearl Harbor. They're still digging up ships, and I'm down there taking a drink at that stop the night before my 16th birthday. I remember that, and it stayed down. And then I couldn't breathe. My throat hurt, and I just... All of a sudden, I found myself feeling significantly better. I didn't notice anything. And I didn't think anything about it. I just thought, I now know why people drink. It makes you feel better. And the next day, they took me to Honolulu and got me four bottles of beer, and I got drunk, and they laughed, and I laughed. No big deal. I didn't become a raging alcoholic. I just added to my storehouse of information. And later on in the war, I went to the Navy, and I got old enough, and at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital in Northern California, and they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests. So I got a high school diploma out of it. I'm still a junior in high school. And I went to the University of Wisconsin after the war, and in the first class of veterans, and I won a couple of trophies for the university, and I went out in the world, became a sports writer, married this lovely girl with black flashing eyes and black flashing hair, something you never see around where I live. Of course, you might know she turned out to be a Catholic. But I loved the job as a sports writer, but then she began manifesting the behavior patterns of Catholicism that I did not know. And that is this. If you have any Protestant kids here, you marry a good Catholic, you are about to have a big family, bucko. You know, whether you want or not. I remember saying, can't we use birth control? No. I don't know what I'd have done if she said yes. It's hard for young people to realize how different things were in those days. Here I was. I'd been overseas. I'd been through a major university. I was hip, slick, and cool. Played piano and dance bands. And I'd heard the word condom once in my life. Maybe in a Navy training film where they showed this voluptuous girl and explained what would happen if you did not use a condom. At that stage of my life, I didn't care what would happen. What you would find then is kids, kind of bad kids, saying things like, I got a rubber. And they'd be ashamed to buy them. They'd have to hire someone depraved to go in and buy them. And even they'd be ashamed. They're going to say things like, give me a pack of cigarettes and some rubbers. Now look how much progress we've made in the last 50-some years. Drugstore over my house, kids come in and say, hey, give me a package of condoms and some cigarettes. Yeah. Incidentally, I must say this. This has nothing to do with AA. But as I go around this building, I see the same sight I see all over the world. Cold, rain, sleet. The poor smokers out there fired up. Like, they should ring bells. Unclean, unclean. Yeah. I smoked a pack and a half or two packs a day for over 40 years. I'd still be smoking if my throat hadn't gone. And I still, my heart goes out to smokers. What a hard life. And not only that, but people think they have the right to come up to total stranger smokers. Why do you smoke? You know you're causing secondhand smoke. You can damage my health. Yeah. And I just want to say, they were doing that and I was smoking. I finally found an answer to that. Then I had to stop smoking. But to those smokers in this room, I'm going to give you something you will never hear in any other meeting of any kind in this world. This is my creation to stop those people. When they come up and say, why do you smoke? Just say this. Why do I smoke? I have a feeling that one of these days they'll find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. Well, they never ask you again, I'll tell you that. When I went out in the world, I got some good jobs and had to get better jobs in advertising, public relations. All these years I drank and smoked and rioted and did all the things drinkers do. The only problem I ever had when I drink, sometimes I drink too much. Whereas I discovered in psychoanalysis, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And I have a tendency to get a little bizarre. And so I was having some trouble. So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. A long time ago. A lot of you little kids weren't even born yet. Incidentally, I want to say one thing about AA of the future. The young people in this room, the newcomers, are the AAs of the future. And I looked at this young man who got the book. Is he still there? There he is. In the future, all the AA leaders will have orange pants. It's going to be really picturesque. But I got in a jam with Fairbanks Morris. So I was working as a writer, and to get out of the jam, they said, why don't you go to AA? No, even before that, I guess when I was still at the university, they said, why don't you go to AA? And I went to AA and went to a room with a bunch of old guys sitting around the table. I felt like I was back in the ship again, guys in their 40s and 50s. And I was 22. And I didn't know why they treated me so oddly until I realized later that there wasn't anybody within that state within 15 years of me. I was like being back in the ship again. I remember the guy said, what the hell are you doing here? And I said, well, Some people thought I had to come to see what's about. She said, you think you're an alcoholic? No, of course not. She said, what do you think's wrong with you? I tried to be honest. I said, I think I'm too sensitive. Listen to this, LeMoyne. You know. And I sat around there for a while. And from then on, when the heat was on, I went to AA. Because AA was not very well known then. You could always, in a corporate situation, you'd start missing days. And they say, what are you going to do about this? I said, I'm going to this new thing called AA. They give you a few days anyway to get your things together. And you can go home, even go home and say things like, well, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful, wonderful. They're going to help you, I know it. What do they want you to do? They want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody anywhere. Now they don't want you to taper off. You're not supposed to stop entirely. We have the same steps you do. I release you, you son of a bitch. Well, I went to AA and I went to psychoanalysis and I read books and I never could understand. I didn't learn much. I didn't learn how to stay sober. I certainly learned what an alcoholic was. That's why I knew I was an alcoholic. And if you're new to that, the gentleman here with the week, you know what an alcoholic is. Everybody knows an alcoholic. There are people whose problem is alcohol, and they come to Alcoholics Anonymous and admit their problem is alcohol, and then they return to God, and then they learn some methodology, and they live better lives after that. Yeah, that's what it is. It didn't take me long to learn that, and I learned that from then on. And every time I went to AA, it was the same thing. I have all these steps on the wall, like the Ten Commandments. There are 12 steps, same thing, but you know, going to do all these wonderful things, and things are going to work out perfectly. And it isn't me, because my problem really isn't alcohol. I wish to hell it was. My problem is feelings and emotions and people not treating me right and not feeling like I'm something and having to always, and I never thought about this until I was sober a number of years. But what drinking did for me, I never knew it at the time, never knew it except in retrospect. It happened when I was 15 years old. When I held that alcohol down, that was the first time in my life I ever felt the way men looked. And I realized later, men don't feel as well as they look. I was feeling better than they were, but I didn't know that. And the last drink I took with my teeth kicked out and standing on a street corner, somebody said, why do you drink? I could give them psychoanalytical reasons. I could give them reasons about my background. I could give them all sorts of self-pitying reasons. But it's the only way I know that it helps me feel the way men look. And it isn't really just that, but it's something. And they say, you'll hear these AA meetings. Well, if you're an alcoholic, you start drinking, sets up, you can't stop. I can stop anytime. That's no problem. I've stopped every place that I've ever drank. My problem is this, unlike alcoholics. When I stop drinking, I feel all right, but once I get over the sickness. But sooner or later, sometimes the next day, sometimes a few days later, somebody sneaks into my bedroom and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it comes out just a little growing restlessness, a little growing irritability, a little growing tiredness of the black and white world I'm in. Then they start lecturing you. Now do it and die for this. And I get very upset. Everything you got, I'm giving you. Why don't you get off my back? And a job, I'm making him look good in his company. He wants to give me these damn lectures. If you don't like it, why don't you do it yourself? And it builds up. And I've tried all sorts of things, reading and psychoanalysis. But nothing ever cuts that feeling, really, other than two or three drinks. And I eventually take them. But I want to explain to people, I'm not drinking because I'm a drinker. I'm drinking because I'm a feeler. I don't know how to explain that. And then sometimes I drink too much again. And they say, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? And you have to say, yeah, I guess it was. You were right. But inside your voice wants to shriek, but you don't understand. I'm not. My case is different somehow. I don't know how to explain it. And what can I do about that? And I have feelings of just almost as old phrase now, but I remember saying the first time, like there's a hole in me and a cold wind blows through sometimes. And I just can't stand to be like that. Nice drink. So my lifetime job has been, how can I drink and not get in trouble? You know, I heard chapter 3 read 100 times. They read it a lot in the West Coast. I was sober a couple years. I suddenly realized, my God, that's my story exactly. And if you're new, you may wonder what you got in common with all the people here. One of the things you got in common, pal, you may not realize it, but all of us have somewhere along the line have had to voluntarily accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. I'll say, I watch people die from it every day. And it talks about we have occasional brief recoveries. We all have that. Followed always by a still worse relapse. If they hadn't had the relapse, we'd still be out there doing it all right. And you keep drinking until you get to that stage. God, I love just, when I think about it, what a delicate choice of words. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just think, when you read that, boy, that's how drunk you get, just pitiful. That is what that means at all. That's how you feel after you're sober again. And now they want to know why the hell you act the way you do. And you just have to say, let me alone. Leave me alone. And what the things people like us do, changing from scotch to brandy or one kind to another, drinking beer only or drinking wine only, or only drinking at home, never drinking at home, all these things, I've done every one of them. But I knew there must be a way to do it. And that's how people like me die. I was strong-bodied and kept me going through terrible times. And eventually I went down in Dallas and it all disappeared. My family finally left me. They repossessed my car. Just everything went to hell. And all of a sudden, I'm standing in the street corner in Los Angeles with my teeth kicked out. And the guy, nobody came up and talked to me. I just stood there. I got to get off the street corner. I'm going to die. How can this happen to me? How can this happen to me? And I said, where's the AA club? That's the only place you can go when you look like that. He said, well, goes on Wilshire and Fairfax. Wilshire doesn't come down this far. He has to go up this hill to Hill Street, over the hill, then cut over to Washington, to Wilshire, go west. My walk. It was raining. And I counted later in my car. That was 72 long blocks. God, what a long walk. You don't know where you're going. And it's raining and sick and my mouth is bleeding again. I got all the clothes I got on, a torn coat with blood in the front of my shirt and vomit on me. And I still remember cars going by and I think, screw you. Got to this club, same old crap. There's the 10 or 12 steps on the wall. And the 12 traditions, and artificially nice people. Oh, hello there, welcome, you're home. Ha, 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 good night. And that night I went to a meeting there, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that, you know. And they had so many meetings, and we talked about gratitude, and I almost puked it up again. Everybody went home, and I was standing there, and it was still raining. I have no place to go. I thought I better put on my newcomer act and get some help here. I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to stay. Could you help me? The guy said, God, you're in luck. Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. Doesn't run, but it's dry. You want to sleep in that? You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? Said, yeah, good deal, huh? Thank you very much. And I slept next to, I still remember my mouth really hurts about how could I be like this? And I went to the club the next morning, it was Sunday morning, have a spiritual meeting. I had 4 pounds of cake and then somebody talked about God or Jesus or somebody I didn't want to hear about. And I hung around the club and that night there was another meeting. I went to that and ate me. This went on for days, it just kept raining. I remember thinking, maybe I'm in hell. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. Maybe it isn't fire and brimstone. Maybe it's just cold and sick. And your mouth bleeds, and you're cold, and you're hungry, and every day somebody talks to you about AA. I don't remember feeling much worse, I'll tell you. And who would have ever guessed that'd be my sobriety date? Didn't want it to be, had no intention to commit suicide, to stay sober, nothing. Because to me, sobriety is unbearable. And all it would be just dreadful. I've wanted to stay sober. I'll tell you what I wanted to stay sober. I was in jail one night, just overnight. I went to jail a lot overnight. Because I have a tendency when I drink a certain amount to counsel police officers. Tell them that they're my servants, so they better do what I say. I was in jail one night, got in the morning. I said, God, you should have stayed home. I said, yeah. I said, I know. I'll get over. He said, well, you're drunk. Your little son died, and we couldn't find you. It almost made me crazy because I had four little girls and one little boy. And, God, I couldn't stand it. And I remember that weekend, the funeral, Sunday before the funeral, I sat with my two brothers-in-law, two big farmers in Wisconsin, their father. They were all so kind to me. Here, Clancy, have some more coffee. Have some Danish, you know. But their eyes, you dirty bastard. You dirty, rotten bastard. What have you done to our sister? But smiled. And I still remember that day bad. And the next day, we buried my little son when nobody's looking. I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Emsley, this will never happen again. I swear to God. And sometime later, I was down in Texas working again. My drinking was going on a little again. I used to think something, but I stopped it, but I didn't stop. I went back to drinking. But when it started to get bad in Texas, I stopped. I stopped for my dead son. And I really felt good about it. I'm doing this for you, John. And we got along well. But one day after some time, somebody came into my bedroom one night and put something, a visible spring in my gut. And the next day it started. And pretty soon it got bad because I not only had all the ordinary feelings, now I have another one. God, this so-called loving God, has killed my little son who never committed any sins to punish me. What kind of a God would kill a little innocent boy to punish his father? You dare you! And the pressure about it, I didn't like that my job anymore. My daughters, who I was doing it for, they're noise. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. God, let me alone. I'm sorry, we'll play later. I just hate myself for doing this. And I just, God, if I could just have a couple drinks. But you can't. You're taking a vow in a casket. You're not going to do that. And one day my wife took the kids to church, and I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe, turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. And a neighbor happened to be watching out his kitchen window, heard the motor running. I didn't see me come out, wandered over and found me dead in the car. Must very quickly, not dead very long apparently, pulled me out, breathed my chest, breathed my mouth, rushed me to the hospital, determined I was seriously mentally ill, and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And nothing on my commitment paper said alcohol or alcoholic. It said schizophrenic, paranoid. I'd been drinking. Now, that's how I get when I get sober. How can I explain that to people? Alcohol is not my problem. It's the only thing that saves me from being crazy. I'd like to go back someday and find that psychiatrist that made that diagnosis of me as schizophrenic. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good, you know. You old quack, calling me a schizophrenic, some sort of dual personality, you idiot. If I could have my personalities down to two, I'd have been all right. My problem has always been this group that gathers in my head every time there's any heat on at all. Let's get out of here. I don't think we can. Are they looking at us? I don't know. I'll check it out. I used to hear people today say things like, I'm not sure the program's enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol. It reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch him in the face? Okay. Now, why would I stay sober this time of all times? Hate it. Hate that everybody's around. Have no desire to be sober. I was waiting for it to stop raining so I could make my move out of there. It just kept raining for days. And you were supposed to be a member of the club to be in there during the daytime. And the manager took mercy on me. He said, you're such a mess. He said, you can come in here, but you, two things. You can't mooch, and you got to go to the meeting every day. And God, it just, I didn't mind not mooching, but sitting through those endless meetings and their jolly old success stories is enough to gag a maggot. And one of those meetings, my life changed. I'll tell you why. I looked over, and there was a movie actor in the meeting. And I'd seen him in the movies. Now, that's exciting to me. I didn't realize he was just a second-rate character actor. He was a movie actor. I'd seen the movies. And at that same time, they were grinding me. You better get a sponsor. You've been sober for days there. You have no sponsor. I'll have one soon. And I sidled over to old Bob. I said, Bob, I really had great admiration of you for a long time. would you be my sponsor? He said, sure, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis. And I had a plan going. We're going to share his fame and fortune. I'm going to get some money. I'm going to get some teeth. I'm going to get some clothes. I'm going to go back to New York and say, yes, I did go on bad days, but it's all over now. I've learned my lesson. Give me a job for nothing in your advertising agency, and I'll prove what kind of writing I can do. And I'll pretty soon give me a good salary. I'll save some money. I'll come back to Los Angeles one day. I'll buy the AA club, and I'll burn it down. And I hope they're all in it, having a group meeting. And so this guy became my sponsor. They said he wasn't a good actor, but he was, because he acted decently in the meetings, and that took acting for him. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Do this! Do this! Why would I take that crap? Because he's the only escape hatch I got, this guy. And I'll tell you, but he took me to meetings a couple times, and he talked to me a lot when he saw me. And I found out later he didn't like me. And I don't blame him at all. I was the worst type of newcomer that I know of extant in AA at any time. And I've known other people like me, and they are terrible. And I've had a couple to work with. Long-term slippers who know all about AA, but are still drinking. And I could say things to my sponsor like, Bob, I think you're misquoting the book there, aren't you? It makes him crazy. Made me crazy. But I think the thing is, as I've thought about this over the years a lot, what saved my life somewhere along the line is when I heard him explaining to somebody, maybe to me or somebody else, about he said something to the effect that if you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. I asked him about that. I said, that doesn't make sense, Bob. He said, if your problem is alcohol, you don't need AA. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. What do you need, psycho-cybernetics, Bob? Is that it? He said, no, you quit drinking, and that's the end of it. Clean up your act, and you're all right. I said, oh, Bob, that's so stupid. That doesn't work. I've done that 100 times. My emotion won't permit me to do that. It's ridiculous. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol, kid. He said, you got something else. I said, what is it, Bob? He said, something called alcoholism. I said, oh, man. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Maybe smarter than you are. Alcoholism. And he got cross and... But he explained it to me over a period of time, long lectures, I guess, as far as I remember. But the gist of it all was this sentence. If your problem is alcohol, you quit drinking and clean up your act and you're all right. However, if you're in this other category, suffer from alcoholism, which for people like us, unfortunately, looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye. This mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism. You'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it another minute. I said, Jesus, Bob, I know that. That's me. But then why would, if alcohol is doing all this to you, why do people even drink it? He said, that's another point. People never seem to understand this. That is what makes alcohol. When alcohol is doing something to you, it's way down the road. That isn't what makes people like us. What makes people like us is this. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people, and we never realize that. But we don't even understand that when I have a few drinks, my perception of reality changes. My relationship to the world around me changes. I'm taller and more self-contained inside, and they're smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because you're getting into an area of fantasy. Nobody else sees it the way you see it. There's going to be conflicts. He also says, it also sets up this craving thing that nobody seems to understand, but you don't have to worry about that. But you have the phenomenon of craving. You know, I thought about that. As the years have gone by and watched a lot of people and thought of myself, I have a theory on what the phenomenon of craving, there's no description, there's no analysis of anywhere in the world. But my particular description for people like me is this. When I drink, it moves me from where I am to where I want to be. And almost immediately, that starts to sag. And I instinctively keep drinking to hold it. Keep drinking to hold it. You ever watch people so drunk they can hardly walk, crying out for an alcohol? You got to have more drink. With that, I got to stay here. Oh, I don't want to go back to Kansas. I want to stay with the give me another drink for crying out loud, you know. But he can't even walk. For pretty soon, you're so drunk you can't drink anymore. I said, Jesus, Bob. Yeah, I understand that. But then if you get sober again, why wouldn't you just quit and be done with it? Why do people just quit? He said, that's the other part of it, kid. Kind of a strange thing. And he had a theory that I hinted at in the book, but I believe it to be absolutely true. I think when Bill wrote in the book, you may learn more than we already know. I think he was absolutely right, at least for people like me. He said, kid, when people grow up, you have to face a lot of things in life. You have to face problems and conflicts and things you like and things you don't like and people you like and people you have to listen to and people you have to listen to and objects and problems. And if you work through them and find solutions and who to stay away from and what to stay from and what to do and what not to do and all the things, that's called maturing. And if you become a mature personality, you live a rather serene life because you realize there aren't that many big deals. When problems come, you either cope with them or you don't get involved in them. You know what's going on. It's wonderful. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. Because as we go along and face conflicts that we don't like and problems we can't stand, I drink and get rid of them. Here's to you, household finance. Happy days. Here's to you, Margaret Jean. I hope you get caught in a ringer. Which is all right, except the day comes and you have to stay sober. And then you find yourself in a situation that you never can learn about yourself, apparently. I never could. In 10,000 years, I wouldn't realize this, my situation. Mentally adult, facile, verbal skills, emotional skills, able to do a lot of things, strong physically, and never once guessing that all of my assets are at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. Now, we call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little more gratifying. Oh, that's my alcoholism, I guess. But they're childish emotions. What are alcoholic emotions? I love you. I hate you. I'm going to run away. Will you marry me? You hurt my feelings, I'll never talk to you again. Let's go out Saturday night. You know. And there's continual child. If you ever want to see alcoholic emotions, stop by a schoolyard at recess and watch. Mine. I love you. You know. And it gets so bad, finally, you got to get some relief. And the relief, the only type of relief I know for people like me, you have a couple drinks. But this time you'll watch them. So you drink till you have to get sober. Then you stay sober till you have to drink. Then you drink till you have to stay sober. And every time back and forth, your brain says, see, it wasn't really the alcohol at all. It's all these other things people don't understand about you. You're sensitive, and you need a little better care than you're getting. And that will enable me to drink till I die from it. And never once will I be unable to say, but you don't understand. I said, Jesus, Bob, that sounds exactly like me. That's me right to a T, Bob. He said, there's a name for people like you. I said, uh-oh. What's that, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. And we're thinking, well, I'll be damned. I'm an alcoholic. I've spent 10 years, I've thrown away every opportunity, every chance, every loving thing I had in my life. Because I never once identified. I said, Bob, why doesn't A talk about those things instead of obsessions of the mind and allergies of the body, this goofy craving, all this crap? Why they just put it simple like that? He says, they do, kid. They call it the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. dash in the English language. Dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you also admit that you're having difficulties when you're not drinking. Yes, I knew that. And I became an alcoholic. I guess that was in January of 1959. And I never really had a strong desire to drink from that day forward. You think, oh, his life turned out wonderfully. Not at all. My early sobriety was as bad as anybody I ever knew because of my smart mouth and my bad attitudes and my imitation intellect. And I got in troubles and got fired off job after job and problems. And I was back sleeping in an abandoned car every so often. Just terrible. You think, well, why would you drink? Because in all the meetings I sat in for 10 years, I listened to these poor slobs talk about how bad things happen on their slips. Yes, my brother slipped, you know, and he killed himself. Or I slipped and I backed over my wife in the driveway. Just one. I thought, if it's this bad now, what the hell would happen to me if I slipped, for God's sake? I gave myself permission to commit suicide, but not to drink. And several times things got bad enough to drink, but not quite enough to commit suicide. And I listened to my sponsor. And I'll tell you something that happened somewhere as we went along. I began to... I had a great thing. I didn't even realize until recently. I heard somebody talking about it. I thought, that was me. I had one of the great all-time lucky breaks of my life. I began thinking, my God, Bob knows how I feel. I had never known a person that I knew of that I thought knew how I feel. And if you're new, this young man new tonight, or anybody else here, if you're having problems, if I could give you one gift more than anything in the world, I hope you find someone that you believe knows how you feel. Not so you'll get more advice. We've all had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. People like us just invite advice. Just invite it. And after a while, you just, oh, yeah, thanks a lot. But if you find someone who you believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. And it's wonderful. I'll tell you, it's wonderful. And you can allow sponsors that way to tell you what to do. And if you're lucky, you'll have a sponsor who will tell you what to do. The trouble is they tell you dumb things. And you have to brace yourself for that. That's dumb. You don't actually say it. You say, But I'll tell you, they don't actually say this, but it sounds like this. See that sign up there? That's vivid red. No, Bob, that's a blue. That's a navy blue, really. He said, I'll tell you it's red. I think it's blue, Bob. Well, you just act like it's red. Now, they don't tell you the color of signs, but they tell you things equally stupid. I want you to apologize to that woman. You called her a bitch. She is a bitch, Bob. She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. Sorry. Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job. But Jesus, Bob, they got me stuffing envelopes. I used to be an executive. I write beautifully. This... I don't care. It's the best job you can get. Hang on to it. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't leave that meeting. But, Bob, it's a big clique. They call on each other, and they all go to parties together, and they treat me like a piece of crap. Well, maybe they know something. Go to that meeting. And on and on and on and on. And one day you turn around, and the sign has turned red. Then you have to spend your rest of your life dealing with dumbbells who think it's blue. I'm almost done now, but I said one other thing I want to say. Sandy gave such a great talk last night about belief in God. I want to talk to the people who can't believe in God, who find it difficult to trust in God. I certainly understand that, because if God exists, I'm damned. And they start talking to me about the steps, and I said, Bob, I can't do the second step. I cannot return to God. If God exists, I am damned. I don't care what anybody says. It's all talk in the world. He says, it doesn't say you have to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself. Does that fool the other boys and girls? I knew who the hell they're talking about, and so do you. He says it doesn't say that. It says came to believe in something. You got to try to come to believe in something. It never asks you to go back to anything, because we're coming out of sick perceptions. You never go back to anything. You come to believe. Can't you believe in God? I said, no, Bob, I can't. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, no, AA is too religious for people like me. I wish I could. I don't help people, not people like me. He said, kid, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power, and I could accept that, because he could not send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. And the thing that saved my life over the next few weeks and months is gradually coming to understand what the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? I was in a nut house. You could read 10 textbooks on mental illness, and you get 10 definitions of sanity. Insanity is easy to define, but sanity isn't. Insanity is psychosis. What says psychosis, to really oversimplify it, when the brain is on sufficient pressure and conflict that cannot stand it, fights for integrity, it will alter a part of reality to make it look different in order to relieve that pressure. The question of why all these people are acting this way, I begin to realize that because they are all against me, trying to kill me. We lost the problem. That's called paranoia and all sorts. If it's widely spread, you'll wind up in the nut house. But you find people like this. Let me read the paper. He was doing so well for 30 years, and one day he took out a gun and shot everybody in the neighborhood. Somebody triggered the right amount of things. Psychosis is a very, very delicate thing. Now, I'll tell you something funny. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that amazing? You'd think we'd be the number one students for it. But they say, well, insanity is the second greatest cause of alcoholic death. Not from that. Alcoholic insanity is a little different thing. It's a physical illness. Everyone in this room who knows, who's ever got drunk, knows how it feels like to wake up in the morning and have that terrible thirst. You got to put the fire out. Got to get some, oh, Jesus, got to get something cold. Why? Because alcohol, this fluid, dries out your body. It desiccates your cells, dries out the cells, kills them. And it kills the cells of your body. But when you drink fluids, it revives the cells. There's only two organs in the body that do not revive, your brain and your liver. When those cells are gone, they stay gone. So if you drink long enough, hard enough, it varies from body to body, your liver goes, and sometimes your brain goes, and it's all dried out. We call it a wet brain, oddly enough. It's called the Korsakoff syndrome, but it's a dried out brain. And people sometimes think, maybe I got this alcoholic insanity. But if you think you got it, you haven't. You've never seen a case. I dare say that most of you have never seen a case of it. I see it all the time. It makes me want to vomit. Guy with Korsakoff syndrome is sitting on a bed somewhere. They come and change his diapers 3 times a day and feed him and put him to bed and get him up and change his diapers and feed him and put him. And they can never get better. Their bodies are healthy. They stay like that for 40, 50 years sometimes. And their families come down to see if Dad knows them. Who the hell are you people? And away they go and cry. That's alcoholic insanity. That's bad news, I'll tell you. Now, why wouldn't alcoholics become psychotic? Because when the conflict gets bad enough, long enough, I take a few drinks and change my perception of reality. Because to me, it doesn't go. Blah, blah, blah. To me, it goes. And then I may drink too much. I get sober again. And the problems are there again. But I literally can induce temporary psychosis. Just remarkable. And so I had to come to believe if alcohol can induce temporary psychosis to get me away from reality, maybe this step means what it says. I have to believe there's some power here that will enable me to live in reality without having to induce psychosis, that will enable me to live sober. The thing you got to remember, if you're new though, you don't have to understand in that step why it's going to happen or how it's going to happen. You just have to believe it's going to happen because there's all people around you. And I could come to believe that. And little by little, I came to understand that for me, the third step was turning my will over to the power, doing what my sponsor said. That was my surrender. And of course, over the years, as life went by, my life changed. I eventually stayed sober and pretty soon got some jobs. And pretty soon I was back in radio and television, quite successful in big corporations. And my beliefs changed because it turns out the purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol does fast, to little by little change my perception of reality, to little by little change my relationship to the world around me, to build up my self-confidence so I could live in the world. And I eventually came to believe in AA as my higher power, much to my surprise. And I eventually, when my sponsor died and I got another sponsor, he eventually showed me how I could pray. And I came to believe in God. And I still was sheepish because I knew God hated me. But little by little, I came to understand that, as I believe today, I believe that God loves me. He loves me as much as you, no more than you, no less than you. He loves us all the same. And he sends us all a pattern of God's grace or serenity or peace of mind. Now, why would these people die in front of where I work? Because they will not change their actions to allow this grace to get through. What AA has done to me is almost though I'm a television set. I got to learn to dial some knobs so I get a picture finally. And I can't sustain it because I'm a human being and I'm fallible and I'm emotional. But the picture is there and I get it from time to time and I can live with some degree of dignity. And as a result of that, my sponsor got me to do things. I made amends to people that I hated. I wrote an inventory I swore I'd never write. So I take my inventory to the psychiatrist. And I continued to do these things, and little by little, my life changed. And I look back now and think, my God, it's 46 years, and I'm the only one left from my class of 1958, because they're all drunk or dead. The people who said, you'll never make it, you little kook. And I believe they were right. It's not because I'm a wonderful man or a good man, but I've been blessed with a very strong sensitivity to pain. And pain has got me to do more things than all the love and kindness in the world, I'll tell you. Pain is the motivator here. I was, because to me, that's why action is so important. That's why I still stay active. A lot of people, sober as long as I have, maybe aren't around much, but I am, because if I don't, I notice the difference. I just want to say one more thing about action. I was thinking about these charming people who gave us a talk last night on starting this meeting 25 years ago and the problems they went through. I have much the same experience. I don't sit down. When I was about 5 years sober in Los Angeles, I was working as an advertising director for a medical corporation, and I was doing quite well, and there's a big meeting in town called the Brentwood meeting. I thought, I should be secretary of that meeting. I got front teeth and claws, and I'm ready to go, baby. And they had an in-group that selected. I had a stooge on that in-group, and I got them to nominate me. They said the next day, did they elect me? He said, no, died for lack of a second. So I realized, well, there's not a groundswell there. But in a little meeting hall called Ohio Street, a guy said, a meeting there just died on Tuesday night. Do you know anybody who wants to take a meeting? I said, yes, I do. And I got 12 of my dreary followers, and we went over there, and I wrote a little format and started something called the Pacific Group, and the first night there were 14 people there, and we had a speaker in addition to that. And the next week there were about 18 people, and I was secretary, and I gave them hell. And next week there was 22 people, and then I think I offended some people who were down to 12 the next week. But at the end of a year, we had almost 40 people coming regularly. And I thought to myself, a lot of groups would have me lecture now. But I would be doing these people a disservice. They're all new. They don't really know how to handle a group. I'm going to sacrifice myself silently. And just out of having an election, I'm going to keep going. And at the end of 2 years, we had about 70 people coming. It was really doing well. I thought, we could have an election now. But God, they're like an emerging third world country. Like an Iraqi election today. There would be just, I would sacrifice myself. Maybe I'll just be secretary forever. And about 3 months later, some boob came up to me after the meeting. Somebody whose life I had saved, I'm sorry to say. So, are we ever going to have an election here? I said, yes, we are. Maybe we are, but aren't we doing it right? We're observing the traditions. We're a very successful meeting. We've got a lot of dilettantes angry at us, which is a great mark of success. And we're doing well. She said, no, don't be angry. Just that other groups around here say this is a dictatorship. And if we had an election and voted you in, nobody could say anything. I said, good idea, Jimmy. So we had an election, and I was swept out of office. I don't care. Now it's, but tell you how good a job I had done, even after I left, it really took off. It's now about 1,000 people every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there. Well, considerably larger than this meeting. Every Wednesday night in a big synagogue in Los Angeles. And I'm not the secretary, but I'm the founder. I sit right in the middle and give little signals. Nobody pays any attention, but I feel good. After the meeting, I stand in the back. I'm always well-dressed, coming from work with a shirt and tie. People bring new people up to me and say, this is Clancy. He's been sober almost 50 years. He flies all over the world to talk to Alcoholics Anonymous members. He founded our group. And the newcomer says, oh. And I say important things like, nice to see you. Hope you brought your problems tonight. Many folks leave them here. Once in a while, some dupe will come up who doesn't know who I am. Say, hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA psych ward after the meeting? And the great thing about AA is this. I've learned this from all my teachers. You can think whatever you want to think. All of our speakers have talked on that subject. I can look right into his sick little beady eyes and think, what? Give you a ride over to the VA psych ward? You're in the right place. There's 1,000 people in this room who need action desperately. There's one who has given all, year after year after year. I'm not just a guy in a suit and a tie. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky. Can't you understand that? Now, I can think that as long as I say, okay. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is this. I drop that puke off at the VA, and as I drive home, my head says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? So to this young man in the orange pants, good luck. There's a program here. Every speaker has talked about it. Some of us here came with doubts and fears. I had to come to here without a God in order to stay here. You have to do what you got to do. But fortunately, there's no place you have to start. You start from where you're starting, and you start from there. And little by little, it gets better. And eventually, you stay sober, and you feel some degree of dignity and peace. And you look back, and it's worth everything it took. Thank you.